We are joined on the line by well-known and respected politician Dr. Ismail Vahdy to speak about his book entitled The Political Backbencher. Ismail Vahdy, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam. How are you?
Alhamdulillah, how are you keeping?
Allah shukr, I'm well.
Alhamdulillah, that's good too. And jazakumullah khairan for joining us on the book review program. We do have Maulana Ashraf Dokrat with us as well. Maulana, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Maulana, salam to our dear guest as well, inshallah.
Jazakumullah khairan to you as well, Maulana, for joining us on the program this morning. This is the book review program, and we are speaking about the book, The Political Backbencher. Ismail, I heard the interview earlier on with Maulana Sulaiman Rawat, and you did mention that you do have a passion for writing, but mostly, it was focused on historical pieces. And this book, even though historical, it was a bit more anecdotal, is it difficult or challenging to write a book like this?
It is. I mean, writing generally is difficult, and therefore I marvel at people who write lengthy novels, etc., with and just at the imagination. This one was not that difficult because it didn't require extensive historical research. So a lot of it was from memory, and as you can see, the chapters are very short. They're 2 or 3 or 4 pages. So there's anecdotes of incidents that occurred, things that I remembered, something that would be interesting, and something that can, there's a moral or a lesson to learn in life or for a politician, depending on what the issue is about. So to write shorter pieces was much easier. It's not full-length chapters, but it does require a bit of research and to make sure that the facts are correct and you've got to verify those things, because sometimes it's not good that you might say something about somebody and it's not absolutely accurate, and it can become offensive, and that's always the danger when you're writing more broadly about other people.
Ismail, can you tell us how difficult, what we look for is your own, apart from the anecdotes, your own personal reflection of being a like you call yourself, a political backbencher. Backbencher is something that comes from the UK parliamentary system. But how difficult has it been as a Muslim to be that political backbencher? We look in the book and see for your own reflections. I mean, during your time at parliament, there were, for example, same-sex marriages were allowed. There's various other things that go against the very core of what you stand for. Do you think your book has covered that sufficiently and given us an insight about being a Muslim minister?
In writing a book like this, you've got to be mindful that it's not a very long book, because I think today the trend is people want something more newsworthy, that's short, that's easy to grasp, and then they move on. So very few people will spend a lot of time reading long books. So you've got to keep a balance between the length of the book and what you want to say. Second thing is, you can't say everything. I mean, in the 16 years just in Parliament, there are so many things that have happened. And as I reflect now, I mean, I said, I should have written about this. But you can't put everything in because, then it becomes too long and people lose interest in the book. So you've got to sustain that interest. You're right. I mean, there are challenges sometimes as a public representative. There are things that might be not consistent with your moral or spiritual outlook or belief system or religious belief system, and one has to find a way of negotiating that. So in the course of my experience, I mean, there are a number of such incidents. One was the abortion bill. It was very early in our term. There was also the issue of liquor, opening up licenses for liquor stores, etc., over weekends. In the old days, under apartheid, liquor stores would have been closed on a Sunday, and people said, but look, what's Sunday? I mean, people should be free to trade. There's the issue of same-sex marriages that has to be administered, etc. Difficult issues, but I must say that from our own experience, you have the Office of the Chief Whip in Parliament, the ANC Chief Whip, and you go and you put your case forward. And you explain the rationale for why this might be difficult or might be, inconsistent with your value system. And from our own experience, I must say that the ANC has always been accommodating. The termination of pregnancy bill or the abortion bill was a particularly difficult issue because the women's lobby in the ANC and in the country was very strongly behind this. But, you know, you speak to the leadership of the ANC. In that case, it was Deputy President Thabo Mbeki. We had made a representation to him more privately. And then the ANC chief whip. And there's never been a moment when the ANC was insensitive to the belief systems of people. And they found a way of accommodating you. So practically what it means today that the vote would be taken, you would be given other responsibilities outside of parliament, formally recorded as that you are on official duty as a way of, you know, accommodating your particular views on the matter or the sensitivities of the matter at hand.
The fact that you haven't mentioned that in your book, was that deliberate to get a broader readership for your book, or how would you explain leaving out that aspect from the book?
No, I don't think it was deliberate. I think it's not, you know, it's not a matter. There would be many such cases, even for other people from other faith communities. I think the basic issue there is really how you manage it. So other political parties, for example, will say they'll allow their MPs a free choice. So you can choose one way or the other, and there will be no issue. Others would have taken a principled view on matter, like, for example, the ACTP, it's a Christian party. It would say that, look, we find that this is against the precepts of the Bible, etc., and they take a particular view. But in the secular parties, I mean, it's important that they accommodate diversity. And, you know, we are a multi-religious society, and each faith will place particular emphasis on particular things. And for secular parties in this kind of environment, it's important that they adopt a more flexible approach. And that is what we have experienced. I mean, as MPs who subscribe to Islam or who were Muslims, there was always an accommodation.
Ismail, when it comes to the book, you know, you have self-published. Take us through, you know, that entire process. You know, just as inspiration to others that want to do it as well.
Yeah, look, publishing has become a very commercialized in our country, and it's a global phenomenon, and books are particularly expensive. So, you know, one of the things that you try and do is also try and keep the cost down and keep the price down so that it's more accessible to people. And the way to do that is, first of all, you need to just get a good manuscript yourself. So an ordinary computer is needed for that, and you can make sure that all the language, the corrections, the spelling, all of those technical sides are done. Thereafter, you know, we don't have to now go to a very big printing house, because there are different costs attached to a printing house, but you can do digital printing, which is much, much, much more cheaper. You can print 3 copies of a book, you can print 10 copies of a book, you can print 50 copies of a book, or 2,000 copies, or even more. So digital printing gives you the flexibility. You don't have to have a big capital layout to print, say, 2,000 or 1,000 copies, because then you've got to lay out that capital, and if you don't sell the books, I mean, it's a net loss for you. So digital printing gives you the flexibility. And if you, I mean, there are so many new entrants onto the market now, so, you know, you don't have to go to the big publishing houses anymore. Of course, it gives you a better stature, or I would say status to the book if it's one of the more, you know, bigger publishing houses. It's a wider audience. But I'm not looking for the Ellen Payton Award for literature or anything. I'm just writing and reflecting on my parliamentary experiences. And so you can go to a good digital printer, print limited copies, you sell that, and then you can obviously do a second run or a third run. It's cost-effective, it's easy to manage. And with social media, you can market your own work. I mean, today, just on WhatsApp and Instagram and those Facebook, etc., the marketing reach is unbelievable. So just a friend of mine told me the other day that they saw my advert in Mauritius. I don't know anybody in Mauritius. But somebody from Mauritius who's a South African living there said, no, they saw the advert and they would want to get a copy. So the whole nature of printing has changed. Of course, there's a place for the more established publishing houses. But I'm saying that if you're a newcomer on the scene, rather have the courage to go on your own, print limited quantities, and get your work out there. It's easier that way, and it's also cheaper for the public.
Also, just for our listeners, I think it's interesting to note that it's been published by Our Reading Tree, Is that your initiative then?
Now, our Reading Tree is not a company or anything. It's just a project I started in March last year. I collect old books from the community, and I give it out to schools, to organizations, to youth clubs, even to individuals. So I just coined this thing called Our Reading Tree so that people can identify with the project. And alhamdulillah, so far I've collected so many books. I've given out in the last, let's say, 18 months, close on to 2,000 books, free of charge, to organizations, to schools, etc. A lot of people don't see the use anymore of encyclopedias. You know, they're bulky, they take up space in the house. But with internet, etc., you don't really need an encyclopedia anymore. Everything's on your fingertip. And they would come and leave it at my place, and I would get it out to schools. They don't have internet connectivity. So Our Reading Tree is not an established, a publishing grouping. It's just a name that I've coined for my project. And I thought it would be good to publish something in its name.
May Allah Ta'ala take it from strength to strength. This is a wonderful initiative, alhamdulillah. We need to promote literacy, especially in our schools. In fact, the Mayfair Community Library is also looking for good books. They've contacted me via the Imam of the Mayfair Juma Masjid, and we're trying to arrange something for them as well there. So
just let me know after the program. Let's talk. And I've got quite a few books that's in terms of my garage.
It seems that it's a family a commitment. I mean, we have the cover for photograph by Zarina Vadi, and then the text is by yourself, and the photos are your own photos. I think that's quite impressive, alhamdulillah.
Yeah, now that's another thing. Photographs can be quite expensive. We were doing another book earlier in the year, and there was a photograph that was particularly attractive, a political photograph, and we traced the photographer to somewhere in the U.S. and said, look, can we use this for a publication? And says, by all means, you can use it, but it's $500.
Sure.
And I said, no, man, we can't afford $500 for one photograph, because then it just shoots out your costing, you see.
Sure.
So I think we go for photographs that are more accessible that are freely accessible on the internet. Over the years, we have taken, as a family and also as other comrades and friends, we have taken photographs of our work. And then you use those. The photographs are important. People love photographs. They want to see something. They want to see images and people and setting and those kinds of things. So it adds value to a book. And any prospective writer should keep that in mind. Your photographs, the collection of photographs you choose, should say as complete a picture of your life as possible. You can't put every photograph in, but it should show the diversity of experiences and the richness of the people that you are in contact with. And that's, I think, what we've tried to do. We've shown big leaders, but we've shown ordinary people from the community, simple projects that we've done, because that's what a public representative's job is. You come into contact with the who's who sometimes, and sometimes you've got to relate to an ordinary person in the street. But that's important also.
Mm. And just to put in a plug for our dear friend, Uncle Yusuf Patel, he has the company Dignity, and you've published with him. And they are able to publish, like you said, on demand, which is wonderful. But coming back to the book now, in terms of the arrangement of the book, you have these subheadings or chapter headings. And like you said, the chapters are small, but they're very, very interesting headings that you've brought, They catch the eye straight away. The tigers are here for Momo's dream, Mr. President, it's a hoax, etc. You've chosen the titles of the chapters very, very well. What is the structure of the book, really?
Okay, so the book is slightly disjointed because it deals with anecdotes and different experiences. So one of the things that I've maintained is just some degree of chronology. So we start off with an earlier period and try and finish up with a later period, although it's not strictly possible all the time. So I've maintained chronology so that there's some sort of reason and logical flow of things as they unfolded. You're right, I've had to apply my mind to the chapter titles because it must be catchy. It must excite the reader to say, "Man, this is something new. Let me write, before I go to sleep, let me read the next chapter." And because it's 3-4 pages, it's easier to read. I've heard people saying that they started reading. Fakir Hassan is a very good photojournalist. He sent me a message the other day because I sent him a copy to do a review more for the newspapers and publications in India. And he said when he started at 11 o'clock at night, he finished the book at 3 o'clock. He couldn't put it down because it was short and quick and fast reading, like it's not intense. And because it's short, you say, okay, let me just look at the next chapter. And then you finish that. But the titles are important. It must interest you. It must be something that says something about what's to follow. And I've also tried to, let's call it a model, but some lesson to learn from each of the experiences, whether it is a public interest matter or a political issue or just a personal reflection, so that you take away something from each little story. That's what I've tried to do.
In that sense, would you say that it's the story of a Sufi maybe who's taken a particular path in life?
You know, the best way to put it is what Chief Mongosuthu Buthelezi said once in Parliament, that I'm just a sinner who's trying. And I think that's what it is.
Okay, exactly.
Ismaba, you spent a number of years in Parliament and so on. Is there hope in the constitutional democracy system?
Look, I think we do have a reasonably vigorous democratic system. Remember, if you look at other democratic societies, the American War of Independence, and it's probably a couple of hundred years, the UK system. So ours is still a young system. It's still in its infancy, I would say, because we've only got 27 years of experience of democracy. And we come from a long period of authoritarian and undemocratic rule. But if I look at the last few years, particularly under the Zuma era, those were testing years, and the system has held out. I mean, if you look at the independence of our judiciary, it's quite remarkable. It's quite remarkable. In mature democracies, you might not have a judiciary that is as independent as we have seen in this country. It has got backbone. It hasn't capitulated. We've got a very, very strong independent media. Of course, nowadays you do have fake news coming out sometimes and all that. But generally, the media has not lost its investigative capacity. If you look at the scandals around PPE for the COVID-19, the health equipment that had to be bought and some of the corruption, the media didn't hesitate. I mean, they blew the story, and we have seen a number of politicians coming in the crossfire. So we have a very strong independent media. And then we have a very vibrant civil society. Many parts, in many other third world or developing countries, you don't see as many as we have in this country. And they are active in all sorts of things that keeps community activism alive, that keeps hope alive. So I think those are three important strengths for the democratic culture, for the strengthening of the democratic culture. And then, look, we've had now, 5 successive elections. They have been free and fair. There's been no, incidents where people will say that the elections are rigged. Even now, in spite of the Constitutional Court judgment, I mean, in a matter of 40-some-odd days, we will pull together an election. And this past weekend, I mean, if you look at the IEC, they have done the voter registration at very, very short notice. So the institutional capability is strengthening, and I think that augurs well for our democracy. What I'm a bit concerned about is sometimes the skepticism of the public. They say, these politicians and the corruption or this and that. But you know what? Every citizen has a responsibility to build a democratic culture. And we mustn't become skeptics. We mustn't become cynical about it. It has taken a very bitter struggle to bring us to this point. And we should rather think positively about defending the democracy and strengthening the democracy rather than withdrawing from it.
You speak in your epilogue of the factionalism within the ANC. And you and others such as Dr. Jasat, etc., have given their lives to the cause. They basically, but at the same time, among the old, the stalwarts, there is this feeling of disillusionment. If we look at the Walter Sisulu Foundation, their statements, some of the Ahmed Kathrada's Foundation statements, there is this growing disillusionment and feeling of betrayal for the sacrifice that has taken place. At the end of the day, would you say it was worth it? I mean, if you look at the ANC today, would you say that it was worth it as a life, even for the movement? Does it really augur well? Look, you are silent about this in your work. You don't touch this aspect much. But this is a question that many of the older guard have, that when we look at the current situation, was it really worth the sacrifice?
Look, I have absolutely no doubt and no regrets about the sacrifices that we have made in the struggle against apartheid and for democracy. I don't think any of the senior leaders regret that stance they took. And there was, many of them were very courageous. But you're right, there is a sense of disappointment, perhaps bordering on disillusionment with what has happened in the last few years in terms of where the country is going, the corruption, the inefficiency that is there, sometimes the maladministration. And the choice is, do you become defeatist or do you keep the activism alive and you work towards correcting, both from within civil society and also within the ruling party or even other political parties? I mean, it's not a peculiar problem of the ANC. Corruption is a global problem, and it's more sophisticated in more mature democracies. The difference there is that there's a greater chance of people being arrested and prosecuted and consequences. And here our own capabilities around, say, the investigation, prosecution, has been weakened, quite pointedly in the last few years. So we've got to rebuild that capacity. So there is a bit of disappointment. But I think, as activists, we don't give up. We keep fighting, either within the party or even outside the party. Who said that, on the 27th of April 1994, all our problems would be solved?
Sure.
No. So we do have a democratic system that is functioning. What is absolutely more important is people's human dignity, at least in terms of the law, the legal framework, has been reaffirmed. Lots of inequalities, lots of challenges of unemployment, poverty, those are still there. And then the big one, the big elephant in the room is the issue of corruption and state capture. But I think the fight is on, and the forces against state capture are growing in this country. And now you begin to see those that that are allegedly involved, they begin to feel the heat. And it's a matter of time. It's a matter of time, I think, when some of them will be prosecuted and jailed.
Mm. Finally, Ismail Bhai, do you think this book tells the Ismail Wadi story well enough?
It wasn't meant to be an Ismail Wadi story. I see some people who've done the one or two reviews call it an autobiography. No, it's not actually an autobiography. In part it is, because it is about my involvement in politics and in parliament, etc. But I've tried to make it more a story about other people, bring in the human element and lessons to learn for young aspirant politicians. People, if you look at today, young people, you tell them, why don't you get involved in politics? They have a negativity. They say, no, man, we can't get involved in that mess. So it's to inspire, hopefully, younger generation of people for them to learn lessons from our own experiences. Those first few years, I can tell you, were so vibrant, were so dynamic. There's so much of energy and enthusiasm that people had. You were literally building a new culture, a new institutional and legal framework for the whole of society. Those moments will never come back. But we have laid, I think, a very solid foundation. And I hope that young people will be inspired. About whether there'll be a book on Ismail Wadi, I don't think so. I think it's more around processes that we were involved in. So as I said earlier on to Mona Suleiman Robert, there's been some people suggesting that we should write about the transport sector. There are enough issues which are of public interest, like the e-tolls, the taxi conflicts. They continue. You still find taxi wars taking place. Six, 8 weeks ago, there were problems in Cape Town when people were killed again, etc. So there are still living issues that we need to find answers to. So hopefully we'll do that. As I said, we are busy with a book on the Transvaal Indian Congress, just to capture that history. And there also is a political motive. The way some people, particularly some of these younger politicians, are talking, as if the Indian community has made no contribution in this country.
Yes, yes.
They have made a very profound contribution. When you consider the size of this community, the numerical size, they have made a very profound contribution to the liberation struggle. And, it's a tragedy that some people can rubbish that history, can vulgarize it in the way that they're doing for cheap political ends. So we have to write about our history and offer an interpretation And of course, some over time, people will reinterpret history. That's natural. But we have an obligation to put into perspective what we think was the contribution of our community to the broader South African body politic. And we don't do that elegantly. It must be good scholarship. It must be based on proper and thorough research. And hopefully the Transvaalian Congress book will do that.
I look
forward to that book.
Going forward, do you have any intention of publishing any other books?
Yeah, there are. I mean, there's so many things. You know, the other day, one of my nephews said to me that, Uncle Isi, we know you were involved. You know, now you wrote about Parliament and all that, but now we were also quite grown up then, so we could follow what you're doing. But we actually don't know what were you doing as an activist, like, say, in the late 1970s, 1980s, because we were children then. And like that, I mean, like that, there are so many other leaders of our movement. We just know them as leaders or their names, but not much has been written about them. So if I take just a person like Dr. Yusuf Jasad, he's made a profound contribution from his days as a student at Wits University in the Transvaal Indian Youth Congress. So we're now going to the early 1950s. People know him as a medical doctor for years and years. I mean, his surgery in Fordsburg. But people don't know the depth of his involvement, the extent of his involvement, his sacrifice. And we need to write about those things. So I would want to write about the activism of the late 70s and 80s, but also of other people. I was telling Mulana Suleiman Rawat that we hear quite a bit now about Ahmed Timol. In October this year, it will be 50 years since he was killed in detention. How many of our younger people actually know the story of Ahmed Timol? Right now, the inquest is going on Dr. Hafaji. He was also murdered and killed in detention. His inquest is on. I am learning for the first time so much about Dr. Hafaji, Hussein Hafaji. We didn't know. It was all kept under wraps. It was secretive. He was killed in detention. And that's it. The family lives with the pain and the trauma, but it's starting to come out. So I think there's still many, many stories to be told across all communities. And, you know, we think we would want to continue in that path of writing and trying to recover some of those things for future generations.
Jazakallah khairan so much for joining us this morning on the book review program. And it's really interesting. I think many of the listeners are looking forward to reading the book, Ismail Bhai.
Jazakallah so much for the interview and for this opportunity. Assalamu alaikum
wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.